This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Let's turn now to some of the other news of the past few days in our Week in Review.
A raise!
The debate over whether to raise the minimum wage continued with demonstrations by fast food workers in Dorchester.
Also, despite the objections of victims' families, Connecticut authorities released recordings of 911 calls made during the deadly attack at Sandy Hook Elementary School.
911, what's the location of your emergency?
Sandy Hook Elementary School, 12 Dickinson Drive.
And international testing results in math, science, and reading show Massachusetts students leading the nation but trailing several countries in Europe and Asia.
We've raised standards, we've provided greater support, we've invested deeply in the quality of teaching, and we've stuck to that for decades.
We'll talk about these stories and more with our Week in Review panel, including Callum Borschers, business reporter for the Boston Globe. Good to see you, Callum.
Great to be here.
Also, Jim Sturgis, executive director of the Pioneer Institute. Hi there, Jim.
Good to see you.
And gentlemen, let's start very quickly. We spent the first part of the show talking about Nelson Mandela, the passing of Nelson Mandela. Just a quick thought from both of you on sort of what you're thinking of on this day. Jim, let me start with you.
Well, I think there are three things that strike me about Mandela. First, his incredible patience. I mean, the fact is he spent 25 years behind bars, much of it in a maximum security prison on Robben Island. And he always kept his vision of his country in mind. A second thing is how incredibly practical he was. I mean, he's somebody who moved over six decades from someone who's sort of a Gandhian to someone who's for controlled violence to prod the system along to someone who could take 5 years to negotiate a settlement with his prison guards. 5 years of negotiating is a long time to get to a place where he could actually be the elected president in 1994. That's a lot of patience, a lot of focus, never wavered from his ultimate goal.
And quite a transformation, as you said. Callum, what about you? What are you thinking of?
I think I was always struck by the fact that Mandela was still so present in our current lives. You know, I think so many folks who were leaders of his caliber in history are folks that many of us only read about in history textbooks, right? You know, you think about the MLKs of the world or Gandhi or going way back to, you know, Lincoln and Washington. And this was someone who was right there, you know, who we could still see speaking. And the other thought I had was that, you know, I was 3 years old when he was released from prison, and I had a classmate in high school who had grown up in South Africa and moved here in the 10th grade. And so for folks of our generation, I mean, he had really no memory, really, of Mandela being in prison or really of even living under apartheid. And I think that it's amazing to wrap your head around the thought that just the progress that he made and that there's a generation now of South Africans who really don't even remember what that was like. It's pretty cool.
Interesting. And, you know, in the many days that we'll be observing the legacy of Mandela, it's interesting to me that he was also someone who was able to admit mistakes. You know, after he left the presidency of South Africa, he talked for quite a while about regretting not having discussed HIV/AIDS more, for example, in sub-Saharan Africa and things like that. So much to discuss about Nelson Mandela amongst all of us in the coming days. But let's turn back now to news here in Massachusetts. And let's begin with yesterday's protests outside of a Burger King in Dorchester, where fast food workers called for a hike in the federal minimum wage to $15 an hour. The labor advocacy group Jobs for Justice helped organize the demonstration. And here's one of their leaders, Melanie Griffiths, hyping up firing up the dozens of workers who attended.
These fast food companies know that the time has come to pay their workers a living wage and the right to form a union. We will no longer tolerate our brothers and sisters, friends and neighbors being retaliated against for speaking out against starvation wages and these bad conditions on the job.
The Massachusetts Restaurant Association begs to differ with the idea that fast food workers should be paid significantly more, and they argued that those pay hikes would mean price hikes for consumers. Here's their president, Bob Lewes.
The minimum wage is meant to be an entry-level wage for workers just entering the workforce. It's not meant to be a living wage. And the amount of hourly workers that move into owning franchises is an incredibly high number. The restaurant industry is the path to middle income.
So, Jim, let's start with you. What's your take on the demand of fast food workers to increase the minimum federal minimum wage to $15 an hour?
Well, I'd say the first thing is it's hard to live on $8 an hour in Massachusetts. It's $320 a week. It's $16,000 a year. And there's an argument to be made that you could actually remove some people from the welfare rolls. But there are also other arguments as well, which is that a lot of people, I think, as the representative of the fast food industry mentioned, a lot of people are not trying to, quote unquote, live on their salary. They're part of a family that has a number of breadwinners. There are also 320,000 residents in Massachusetts who are between the ages of 16 and 19. These are entry-level jobs for them. There are all kinds of studies, right, out there that say it would be a good thing. There are studies that say it would be a bad thing. The ones that I actually put most stock in note that there'd probably be something on the order of a 10%, let's say a 10% increase in the minimum wage would lead to something on the order of a 0.2% decrease.
A 0.2% decrease
for every 10% increase. So if you're going to raise, for example, the minimum wage in Massachusetts in accordance with what the Senate has been talking about to 9 to 10 to 11, you're talking about 10, 20, and even 30,000 jobs that could be lost as a result of that. So it's a question of, do you want to bring people up to a living wage but also reduce the number of jobs that are available to certain individuals? That's a hard trade-off.
Right, Jim. So I think you're referring to some studies that have been coming out of UMass Amherst and their economic policy and economic institute there. We actually spoke to someone from UMass yesterday. I believe she said it's a 2% decrease in poverty levels, but this is nationwide for every 10% increase in the federal minimum wage.
It's actually a study from the Cato Institute.
Is that out of Cato?
It was out of Cato that was talking about a 0.2% decrease in employment.
In employment,
for every 10% increase in the minimum wage.
I see. So the tens and twos floating around. But yeah. Thank you for the clarification. Yeah. Callum, I mean, you cover business for the Globe. I mean, what's your take on the business impacts, positive and negative?
Well, I guess I'm struck in listening to those two sound bites that we played that we're sort of talking about two separate battles in some ways. I mean, one is the idea of, is the minimum wage too low just at face value? And I think that if you look at historical, you know, if you adjust for inflation, I think that we are below. We heard yesterday from, your previous guests that I think in 1960s, in today's dollars, the minimum wage would be more like $10 mm-hmm. or whatever. So clearly we're out of whack historically. But at the same time, you know, if you go to 10 or 10.50 or whatever, is that a living wage? It's still pretty tough to live on. So I think the second part of that debate is, you know, do you raise the minimum wage, but is it should be a living wage? And I think that is a different debate, because many of the folks who occupy those jobs, I mean, I was the burger flipper, you know, in high school, and I had no expectation of earning a living wage at that time. But I think that the type of person who occupies that job has changed over time, right? And I think that that's something that maybe our economy hasn't really fully adjusted to yet.
Well, let's move on to the release of some of the recordings of the 911 calls that teachers and others made from inside the Sandy Hook Elementary School during the deadly school shooting almost 1 year ago in Newtown, Connecticut, that killed 20 students, 6 school staff members. Prosecutors and the families of the victims tried to block release of the tapes, but a federal judge disagreed, and the tapes were released to the public Wednesday afternoon. We spoke to Colin McEnroe, host of WNPR, The Colin McEnroe Show. He's a columnist for the Hartford Current, about the decision to release the tapes. And this is how he describes sort of the best argument for their release.
We don't know what it is we need to know or want to know until we hear it or see it. Now, similar to a lot of people, as I listen to these tapes, I don't really see anything or don't hear anything that substantially enlarges my understanding of this case. But there's no way to know that unless you can actually hear the tapes. You know, ultimately, what you want to do is get enough of this information out so that people don't feel as though something important has been withheld.
So that's one argument. And you know, on the other hand, one can certainly understand the concerns of the families. Incredibly difficult to have those tapes released when it is, after all, the sound of their children being killed. But Callum, what's your view on the release of these tapes, whether it was a good idea, what we learned from it?
I think as a journalist, you know, I think the tendency is to lean for more information, right? And I think I agree with the sentiment that was also expressed by the Associated Press in pushing for this in the first place, which is that this is part of the normal news gathering process. It is a public document. The tapes are a public document. And I think if we sort of quashed any public document that might cause pain and suffering to somebody, then we probably wouldn't get access to very much. I think it's a separate question, though, whether you actually then play those. And I think that every news outlet has to weigh that separately. And I think the medium is important. You know, if you are an online publication or a newspaper with a website, for instance, you know, posting the audio online gives every reader the opportunity to decide for him or herself, do I want to push play or not? It's not sort of pushed in your face in the same way that perhaps a television station has to weigh that option. Am I going to air it on TV where there's really no option. Anybody who's sitting at home watching it is going to be subjected to it. And I think that's a very difficult decision that every editor has to make.
These were certainly difficult conversations that we had about whether to play, what to play, how much to play on Wednesday. Jim Sturgis, where are you on this conversation? And do you think that the tapes in any way sort of increased our understanding of what happened on that day?
I would completely agree with what Caleb said. We wouldn't know until we had an opportunity to listen to them. But I would start by just saying, look, it's understandable why any parent would not want to have these heard. They're trying to heal. And we're close to the one-year anniversary of the tragedy. On the other side, we do want to uphold access to information. The law is the law, and I think we need to uphold that. The medium does matter. I would note one thing as a parent. This is kind of akin to a snuff film, if you think about it. Mm. This is akin to watching beheadings. I think we should not legislate it so that people don't have access to this. I think it should be provided to news organizations. But I would say that as a community, we're not just a community that is defined by the rule of law, but also by trust. And if people out there, even in the online environment, are putting this stuff out there for people to watch, I think as a community we have every right to push back and say, that's really awful, and, mm-hmm. and boycott or whatever we can do, because that stuff, frankly, doesn't need to be out there in that way.
Let me ask you both about the position taken by the prosecutors, because they were arguing on behalf of the families, and some people were suggesting or sort of raising questions about that. That is, they're arguing on behalf of the families who didn't want the tapes released, rather than acting in the interests of the investigation itself. Is that a valid question, Callum?
It definitely is a valid question, and obviously those are sometimes conflicting priorities, you know, that are very difficult to weigh. But I think that Jim is right on the money. I mean, I think that if I'm a news outlet, I want access to that information because there may be something in there that sheds further light on what happened. And
sure.
If there was, I would want to know that, and I would have an obligation to report it. Having said that, if upon review there's really nothing newsworthy to glean in there, nothing that I believe serves the public interest as opposed to just morbid curiosity, then there's really no need to put it out there.
Interesting, because in the modern age, though, for careful news organizations, the review does happen before the information is released, but the tapes were out there basically as soon as the judge made his decision this week through other organizations. So there's that push-pull that Jim was talking about, because not every organization is going to go through it with a fine-tooth comb before releasing information. But anyway, in a few minutes we have left, let's talk about some good news regarding schools and Massachusetts, because results in the latest international standardized test, the Program for International Student Assessment, or PISA, show that Massachusetts students lead the nation and outperform many European countries. So just in case people don't remember, depending how you read the numbers, here's how it breaks down. Massachusetts 15-year-olds rank fourth in the world in reading, behind Shanghai, Hong Kong, and Singapore, seventh in science, behind Finland and Estonia, amongst others, and 10th in math, behind Korea, Liechtenstein, Switzerland, and a couple others. And, you know, it's great to celebrate this success, but first and foremost, well, actually, you know what? Before I dog on these numbers, let me just ask you, Jim, let's start with you. I mean, it's pretty amazing that our state outperforms the rest of the country, and if we were a country, would be, you know, ranked in the top 10 in a lot of these numbers.
Yeah, and we've known this for quite some time. I mean, the trends in math and science study is probably a better test, international test, higher quality test than the PISA test, but we have been outperforming other states for a long time. It says one really important thing. National education policy doesn't really matter that much. Most of the hooks and most of the levers are held at the state and local level, and we've done a very, very good job there. And that's one of the reasons why my organization has opposed a lot of the national educational efforts, because we've done some great experiments here on the charter school side, authorization and closure. We set the highest expectations for math, English, science, and U.S. history. We have a unique test for teacher certification, which frankly makes our teachers a higher quality cadre of teachers. So these numbers are good. I would say this. We're way behind when you take a look at the top performers, mm-hmm. and we start looking at who are the level, the percentage of students who are actually really advanced in these categories, we should be worried there. So we have a lot more work to do. And frankly, one of the things I am concerned about is a lot of the things that we put into place that made these numbers possible have largely been undone, including the level of high expectations that we set before for literature and poetry and high-quality math and science.
Right. So that's one point, that the top performers in the PISA test are way outperforming the rest. But also, Callum, I wonder, these are statewide numbers on average that, if you look at the averages, it still masks major achievement gaps in certain districts around the state, which are very far behind the average in Massachusetts.
Yeah, to me, that's a huge part of the story. I mean, I think that if you look at the top end, you know, students in Massachusetts and the nation are right up there with the rest of the world. And that's very consistent with the folks that I meet on my beat. You know, when I'm covering students at MIT and Harvard, the domestic students are brilliant. They are innovative, creative, and I have no doubt that they can compete in a global economy. But I think that those sort of middle tier jobs perhaps are some of what's missing. So I meet entrepreneurs who are starting, you know, innovative businesses, and they get a little bit farther along, they're growing, and what they need maybe are lab technicians. And these are not necessarily highly skilled workers who are going to work in a tech economy. They don't need to have graduate degrees from Harvard or MIT, but they do need to have some basic math, science, and laboratory skills that they could learn in high school, or they could learn, you know, in an associate's program. And I think that maybe that middle gap is really what's missing, and that's what I take away from these numbers.
And just very briefly from both of you, you know, sort of another a subhead to this story which interested me is that there's been a lot of pushback in recent years to the whole concept of standardized tests. And I'm wondering what the PISA outcomes tell you about whether or not standardized tests are a good or a bad thing in terms of accountability, performance, and even just the metrics of being able to measure how students are doing. Callum, why don't you start?
I guess I'm sort of conflicted. I was telling Jim before we came in, I actually spent my morning at a school in Cambridge called New View, you know, very small, like 30 kids, you know, private school is tuition, and there's no grades, no traditional classes. You know, kids go there for 12 weeks and they work on technology-based projects, right? So there's no testing there, and they come away with incredible skills. So on the one hand, you look at that and say, why do we need testing? On the other hand, I'm very conscious of the fact that you need some barometers, right? I mean, you need some markers to know, well, how are we doing? Just and if they're not standardized across the rest of the country, you know, you're always comparing apples and oranges.
And Jim, I imagine that you don't believe the parents, or you don't agree with the parents who say that standardized tests just stress their kids out too much and are measuring all the wrong things.
I really don't, because I don't think China is really terribly worried about that. I don't think Japan is, and I don't think Korea or Singapore and our other competitors are. I would say there are two purposes for standardized tests, and we should not make them what they're not. One is a barometer, and have a common barometer. The second thing is, and this is what Tom Birmingham, as Senate President, when Bill Weld as governor, when they pushed this law that in 1993 that changed the face of education in Massachusetts, what they believed was, and this is largely Birmingham, he's a kid from Chelsea, and he said, My classmates didn't have access to great literature and poetry. It only goes to Weston and Wellesley. And the other purpose of standardized tests is to make sure that basic, high-quality liberal arts content gets into the classroom. So I think that's really actually a really probably an even more important part of it.
Mm. We have literally about a minute left for a couple of hubbubs from either one of you gentlemen or both of you gentlemen. Let me come to you. This is the story that fell below the fold that might not have gotten the attention that we wished it had. So, Callum, let me start with you with your hubbub this week.
Well, real quick, I'll go back to Newtown, and this is a positive one. I'm writing for Boston.com today about this guy named Adam King. He's in Jamaica Plain, and he has launched an Indiegogo campaign. This is a fundraising website, crowdfunding website, called Notes for Newtown. And the idea is to send handwritten notes to the families who lost loved ones that day, a year after the fact, so they remember that they were not forgotten. It does cost some money for the paper and the stamps. You can submit your message online, and they will do the handwriting for you. So there's really no excuses. But the idea is, you know, we all know how special it is to get that handwritten note. So,
and Jim,
pretty cool.
In the 30 seconds or so that remains, give us your hubbub.
Sure. I think you probably expect me to celebrate the 5.25 income tax dropping to 5.20, but it's not true. I want to speak of prohibition. It ended yesterday, 80 years ago. I spent the $42 I'm going to save in next year's income tax savings celebrating. I celebrated last night. I would urge all listeners to raise a glass to the 21st Amendment this holiday season.
Here.
You could even raise it at the 21st Amendment if you want.
Jim Sturgis, Executive Director of the Pioneer Institute. Thanks so much. Have a great weekend. And Callum Borchers, business reporter of the Boston Globe, same to you.
Always a pleasure.
Well, stay with us because coming up, we'll speak to the Berklee College of Music student with a big new role in the film adaptation of Black Nativity. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.